Good day, and welcome to episode 28 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. In today's episode, we examine the recent legislation from the Ford government here in Ontario that threatens our important conservation areas and our green spaces. Our guests are MPP Mike Schreiner, Guelph Conservation and Trails Advocate Bill Mungle, and Mississauga of the Credit Elder Nancy Rowe. I should mention that Nancy's land acknowledgement is not included in this recording. Here's our moderator, Dustin Brown.
And I just hit record. So, okay, welcome everybody. It's the January 14th, 2021 edition of Breezy Breakfast. Hopefully everybody is up to date more or less on what's happening with conservation authorities, where there's a Conservation Authorities Act with a Schedule 6 that was kind of slipped through the Queen's Park legislature over while people were preparing for the holidays. And this has really significantly impacted the ability or the projected ability of conservation authorities to hold development to account, to science-based decisions around watershed management, flood protection, and wetland protection, things like this. It's not something that was passed without resistance. There was a mass resignation on Ontario's Greenbelt Council, including the chair, David Crombie, who is actually a former Conservative minister. So it's a very significant political resignation. And at the same time, the Green Party of Ontario has been mounting a pretty massive campaign and called it one of their biggest campaigns of 2020 against Schedule 6. So today we've got MPP Mike Schreiner and Bill Mungle, who are going to share their perspectives on everything going down here. And Mike, I'm going to ask you to go first whenever you're ready to go with your intro.
So thanks, Dustin, and thanks, Nancy, for sharing with us. And I want to just quickly say this, related but not completely related, at the same time that the budget bill with a Schedule 6 for conservation authorities was going through, there was another omnibus bill that was going through the legislature that came to the committee that I was on that dealt with water-taking permit applications. And I tried really hard through amendments to require the government to work and get consent from treaty holders when they would allow the issuing of water taking permits for bottled water operations. And unfortunately, that amendment was defeated. But I continue to try. Almost every bill that comes up before my committee, I'm always trying to get treaty rights put in, treaty right amendments put into those bills. And I've actually succeeded once. So I haven't failed every time, but anyway, so thank you, Nancy, for sharing. So quickly on conservation authorities, it's interesting. Many of you will probably recall Schedule 10 of Bill 66 that would have opened up the Greenbelt for development and undermined the Clean Water Act that was introduced in December of 2018. And a citizens movement was mounted against that, and it was withdrawn when it came before committee, and actually my committee, the committee I sit on in February when the legislature reconvened. And I think if we'd had that kind of time, we would have been able to remove Schedule 6 from the omnibus budget bill because opposition was mounting. And as Dustin has noted, the Greenbelt Council had mass resignations. But I also want to point out another very prominent conservative politician who is the chair of the Toronto Region Conservation Authority wrote a pretty scathing op-ed highlighting how what the Ford government is doing is really undermining not only the province's history around flood protection and proper stewardship and land management and watershed management, but actually undermining the Conservative Party's own history and contributions to that. And so essentially what the government has done has gutted the ability of conservation authorities to make science-based decisions around watershed management. And if those of you who know Elizabeth Snell here in Guelph, she wrote an excellent op-ed in the Tribune, probably in 2017, that was based on a federal government report that came out in 2016 that highlighted the fact that Ontario, compared to other provinces across the country, has done a better job in helping to mitigate flood damage. And primarily they point to the role that conservation authorities have played in good watershed management. Obviously, we're not going to prevent flooding, but the more we can have good land use planning, and primarily that good land use planning is ensuring that we don't pave over the earth's ability to absorb excess water, that will help mitigate flooding. And that the CAs have actually done a pretty good job in that regard. And just a little quick history lesson. So the CAs were brought in the 1930s as a way to, or 1940s, to address what happened in the 1930s. And then were strengthened in the 1950s after Hurricane Hazel. And if you recall Hurricane Hazel, 81 people lost their lives and 2,000 homes were destroyed due to flooding. And it did billions of dollars in damage. At that time, it was the most expensive extreme weather event in Canadian history. And so conservation authorities were strengthened after that and have played a very vital role in watershed management. And so specifically what the bill does to undermine conservation authorities is, one, now the minister has the power to issue development permits. And that then enables the minister to override the science-based, evidence-based watershed management that conservation authorities provide and that guide their decision-making process. So it basically really takes the decision-making process out of the hand of scientists and put it into the hands of politicians and politicizes those decisions. The next thing I can do is the minister can actually take over a conservation authority if they deem that it isn't operating in the way that's satisfactory to the ministry and it's unclear around what the conditions of such a takeover would be. But one of the concerns I have is if the conservation authority is denying development applications on a consistent basis because of sound scientific evidence, and the ministry takes it over, that could have, you know, seriously undermine the ability of conservation authorities to, you know, protect us from flooding and to protect our drinking water, because they play a vital role in source water protection as well. In addition, now developers can appeal conservation authority decisions to the LPAT, and which raises serious concerns around, one, cost. So LPAT appeals are very costly and tend to benefit those with deep pockets, usually developers, over those with less deep pockets, citizens, municipalities, and conservation authorities. And essentially, changes that the government brought into the LPAT process last year essentially is, in a sense, made the LPAT process essentially the OMB, the Ontario Municipal Board process. Essentially, we've reverted back to the OMB process, just under a different name, the LPAT process. And those of us in Guelph understand, because you know we've had a challenging history with OMB appeals, of how expensive that can be, and how oftentimes decisions around those appeals favor developers over citizens and scientists. So there was mounting opposition to Schedule 6. I was doing everything I could. I literally every question I asked in question period over the last 4 weeks of the session or 3 weeks of the session were all about conservation authorities and really trying to push back on the government. And their response to that was not to make amendments to, you know, strengthen conservation authorities or to pull the schedule. They actually doubled down and made it worse. And so at the last hour, they put in and passed an amendment that would force a conservation authority to issue a development permit if a ministerial zoning order was issued. And so I think this has been primarily in response to the opposition to a ministerial zoning order in Durham Region that will pave over Duffins Creek, which is the last major provincially significant wetland in the GTA along Lake Ontario. And essentially, they've issued a ministerial zoning order for that that will allow a casino to be built and a warehouse to be built on a provincially significant wetland. And there is local opposition. So the mayor of Pickering supports it, the mayor of Ajax opposes it, but the government implemented it anyway, and the Toronto Region Conservation Authority opposed it. And so that, I think, is what prompted the government to make that amendment. And then the other amendment they made, which is related to this proposal as well, is that the minister can require a conservation authority to essentially put forward what I call a pay to pave, or some environmentalists have called a pay to slay provision, that would allow a developer, if they destroy a wetland, to essentially pay to have, quote, another wetland built. But, you know, if you listen to any scientist or anybody who, you know, hydrogeologists or anybody in watershed management will tell you that you can rebuild wetlands and you can enhance wetlands, but you can't replace wetlands. Like the Earth's ability to create a wetland and the biodiversity there, you can't replace it. And so you might be able to say, yes, we'll put some money into building another wetland, but it won't be as effective from a flood mitigation standpoint, a biodiversity standpoint, an ecosystem standpoint, et cetera, that it's irreplaceable once it's lost. And to put that into perspective, in Southern Ontario, we've already paved over 75% of our wetlands. In some regions of Southern Ontario, like Niagara, for example, we've paved over 90% of our wetlands. And wetlands are the key way that we protect ourselves from flooding, and that we they provide a vital water recharge service to help keep our drinking water clean. And so there's been, you know, numerous research studies, including from academics at the University of Guelph, that clearly indicate that there are two factors driving increasing flood risk in Ontario, and especially Southern Ontario. Is the number one is the fact that we're paving over wetlands and green space. And so to continue, and to, in the case of the Ford government, essentially accelerate the paving over of wetlands and green space is only going to make the cost of flooding worse, and it's going to escalate the risk to people's lives and property. And then the second contributor, which is more of a future contributor, but we're starting to feel the effects of the climate crisis. So we know that the largest climate risk in Southern Ontario is flooding. Like, we have lots of climate risks from crop loss and droughts and ice storms and other extreme weather events. But in Ontario's case, flooding is our biggest risk. And to put that cost into perspective, every year over the last 5 years, insurance companies have paid out over $1 billion for extreme weather events. And the estimate is the cost of public infrastructure is three times that amount. And so one of the cases I've been trying to make with the government, and I'll close on this because I am aware of the time, is that to me, this is a completely, not only is it an irresponsible move from a protect the environment, protect people's lives, protect people's property, it's an incredibly fiscally irresponsible move, because this move is going to cost us billions, and it's going to put huge pressure on municipalities in particular, because municipal infrastructure now is at significant risk. And it's unclear who's going to pay for that. And conservation authorities deliver flood protection and water protection services at a very, very low cost. So in the case of the Grand River Watershed, which is the conservation authority in our area, we essentially pay $2.80 for flood protection every year. And to put that into perspective, the average cost to repair a flooded basement in an individual's home is $43,000. So I would argue $2.80 is a pretty damn good deal. And if you talk to Conservation Ontario, they'll even tell you that many conservation authorities actually deliver those services at an even lower cost than Grand River, because obviously the Grand River is one of the largest and most complex watersheds and conservation authorities. And so my hope is that we can, I haven't given up this fight. So my hope is one of two things can happen. So one, I've been trying to work a lot with conservation authorities to try to influence the regulations the government's now going to bring in now that the bill is passed. And two, I'm working with a number of environmental organizations right now to put developers on notice that at least our party, and we're hoping other opposition parties, will revoke Bill 6 after the next, or Schedule 6 after the next election, and to put them on notice that they could be at risk if there is a revoking of the bill, and trying to figure out legally what is the most responsible and appropriate way to address that. And with that, I think we'll let, I don't know if you want me to take questions or if Bill's going to speak, and then we both take questions, but I'll leave it there.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Yeah, we're going to go to Bill. But yeah, thanks for outlining your perspective there. I hope all the homeowners out there consider deeply what you said about flooded basements. So yeah, Bill, I'm going to invite you to introduce yourself and your familiarity with conservation authorities. And then if you're ready to share your thoughts, then the floor is yours.
Sure. And thanks for inviting me to this session. I am quite flattered. I have had knowledge of and involvement with conservation authorities off and on over the years. I was a former general manager of an authority further in southwestern Ontario, albeit 40 some years ago, but that long-term view, and more recently I should say that I chaired an urban flooding an interministerial urban flooding task group for the Ministry of Municipal Affairs in my last job with in the course of 35 years with the provincial government. But and currently I work as an advocate for trails, primarily on behalf of Hike Ontario, which represents all the hiking clubs in Ontario, advocating more open space planning, more acquisition of open space, and more trail development. And I want to tie that back into some of the things that Mike was saying about the longer view of conservation authorities, which as a 69-year-old, I'm old enough to remember some of the salad days of conservation authorities under the PC governments of Leslie Frost, John Robarts, and William Davis. And that takes you right up to about 1985. And over that period, post-war through to 85, the conservation authorities thrived under the partnership that had been set up by the province to be primarily locally driven, but with a significant amount of funding provided by the Ontario government. And as a result of that, that's why you see today numerous conservation areas, most of which still exist despite funding cuts, and other open space that's been acquired. And even in Guelph, there's a considerable body of open space that was acquired by the authority with provincial grants. Often they're disguised as city parks, but they're actually owned by the conservation authorities. And that's thanks to both the partnership of the province and the municipalities to acquire those. Now, in 1995, 96, you may remember, those of you old enough to recall the Common Sense Revolution of Mike Harris. The first thing they did, of course, was cut welfare by 22%. But one of the things hard on the heels of that was cutting Conservation Authority funding by 80%. There was $26 million for many, many years through the late 70s and 1980s and into the 90s. And the axe fell on that as one of the Common Sense Revolution cuts. There was even more cuts to that little bit of funding that was left under the Eaves government as well. The tragedy, though, is that the Liberals never restored this in subsequent years. And so the conservation authorities are limping along with what's supposed to be a partnership between province and municipal governments. But in effect, what's happened is that the province has looked at this partnership and decided that they would be opportunistic and download the financial obligations that they had under the Conservation Authorities Act and download these onto the municipalities, which was a big theme of the Harris government in the first instance. So the authorities have really never recovered from this. They have been hard-pressed to even maintain major flood control reservoirs that have been built. For instance, the Grand River Authority had to scramble and lobby hard just to get enough money to repair the gates of the Conestoga Dam, which was built in 1952 on the Conestoga River west of KW. And that saga continues. There's just minimal support for any but the province deems to be the core functions of conservation authorities, and not even for that. And yet, when the legislation was first drafted in 1946, as Mike was correctly recalling, the scope of the Conservation Authorities Act was essentially to allow the authorities to devise whatever program of water management and other related resource management in their watershed that they felt served the municipalities best. The only thing authorities couldn't do was to start open a mine underground, but they could do just about anything else in terms of purchasing floodplain lands, building dams and reservoirs, dike systems, protecting groundwater. All these things were envisaged in the original Conservation Authorities Act in 1946. Although the Act remains intact, apart from the serious amendments that Mike described, the vision has been truncated radically over the years by funding cuts and by these recent attitudes of this government, to the effect that authorities have no business doing except a very narrow range of water management functions, which they are prescribing that the authorities do, and then not funding them sufficiently in any event. I wanted to speak to just one other major matter from the standpoint of Hike Ontario. Our member clubs, of which there's about two dozen around the province, routinely interact with conservation authorities because our trails cross conservation authority land. The authorities themselves manage about 3,500 kilometers of trail. That's a number that's not generally known, of hiking trails on their property. Our member hiking clubs manage about another 4,000 more, largely on private land, but also on conservation authority land. And what we've seen prior to COVID, but particularly extended by COVID, is the great need for more places to get out and stretch your legs and walk, and particularly in proximity to urban areas, major urban areas. In the local Guelph area, the shortfall that we're seeing, because there hasn't been development on most conservation authority properties for many years for hiking trails, so you see things such as cars spilling out onto Arkell Road next to the Starkey Hill Trail, which is owned by the Conservation Authority. You see 20 cars last Sunday on Niska Road, where there's a trailhead for one of our trails that leads onto private property and Conservation Authority property. There's a great need for people to recover from COVID, both the physical effects, but particularly the mental health effects by accessing open space. And the current attitude of the province in terms of both funding and the scope of the program of conservation authorities isn't going to help that situation one iota. And I think that's, in a nutshell, how I see the current crisis is simply the province has blinders on in terms of how to recover from COVID, maybe haven't just thought about it enough yet. Pike Ontario, for its part, and something I was involved in, I chair an advocacy committee of Pike Ontario. And back on June the 12th, we partnered with the Ontario Parks Association, the Ontario Public Health Association, TransCanada Trail, the Ontario Trails Council, and we all wrote a joint letter into the province outlining three specific areas where we felt that more needed to be done in terms of recovering from COVID, particularly related to trails and open space. And the unfortunate part of this was that the letter was addressed to the former minister, Rod Phillips, and Mr. Phillips never deemed this, never took the time to reply to this letter, unfortunately, which was very well crafted and essentially saw a role for the conservation authorities in recovering from COVID to the benefit of the citizenry who always value the development of new trails and open space opportunities whenever the authorities or hiking clubs are able to put them together. But currently the attitude and the funding is simply not there for the province to be a partner that's really living up to the responsibilities in a partnership with all the 36 conservation authorities. The province is coming up short. That's probably enough. I'm sure I've spoken much longer than 5 minutes here. So I'll turn that back to you, Dustin.
No problem, Bill. Thank you for the comprehensive coverage there. I'll just say quickly before we move into the Q&A, I guess we'll see how long we're allowed to gather at the heads of trails and go out for walks with this emergency order that, I don't know, this very confusing emergency order, I'll say, that's coming our way in effect today. But that aside, there are a few questions that piled up. We have less time than usual for Q&A. So I'll just ask that anybody answering questions can keep that in mind and try to keep your answers brief, but pithy if you can. And I'm actually going to go to Morgan's question first, which was, given the new legislation and the propensity of the government, the Ford government, to use ministerial zoning orders, do we need to worry about the possibility of the planned community park on the north shores of Halls Pond and Clare Maltby being jeopardized by the current landowner? So Mike, Phil, James, I don't know if you have a perspective on that, but please share it.
I'm going to let the councillors answer specifically, but I will let people know that I can get links to people, but there is a provincial review of the use of ministerial zoning orders right now, and it would be great if all of you would comment on that, and then I'll turn it over to Phil.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks for your presentation on the conservation authorities. Morgan, your question is quite important. It really relates to the whole planning process. And the answer, regrettably, is yes, that particular proposal or possibly request from a landowner could come at any time. And just to steal a Yogi Bearism, it ain't over until it's over. There is the possibility that if we had a council that had a majority inclination to request an MZO, that could occur. I'm not convinced that we would have the council that would do it, but because of the cavalier use of MZOs and the planning process, I do not believe that anything is settled until you finally see the finished project. It's much like what I've said about libraries. I won't believe Guelph has a library till I sign out the first book. I won't believe that we have a park down there until such time as we have a park.
I'll just add, if I may, and yeah, thanks, Mike and Bill. Another important aspect of your question, Morgan, is that I can't speak for Phil or my other colleagues, but I certainly will not support any kind of development. I'm reluctant to support the Clare Maltby development. Reluctant to support it as it is, but if somehow through MZOs and policy we erode what little conservation control we have there, what little natural and wetland regeneration space we have, I certainly can't support it. So it's going to change the conversation, which in some ways, Phil, you might agree, isn't a bad thing. If we start to focus on that as a need, then we can advocate. But I think I see other questions too.
Yeah.
Since this bill has already been passed, it is really hard to know how we as a council can advocate. And to answer Morgan's other question, MZOs, they come straight from the minister at the province. We can't will them or deny them as a council.
Yeah, and actually I want to follow up because Mike said something really important that I think relates to this. If you are really, really concerned that MZOs could be used in Guelph, and I believe they could be. I've heard our mayor say that he'd like MZOs to be used in Guelph. I think it is important to do exactly as Mike said and to provide input on limiting these. This is, I think, one of the most anti-democratic things this government has done. There was and still is, in limited cases, a rationale for MZOs, but those are limited cases. And what we're seeing now is that it's open season on essentially ignoring local democracy. So I would say help Mike in his job, please, and do some input on this particular issue. It's essential to the future of Guelph.
Great. And I see Candace just sent us the link in the chat to the review of the use of MZOs. I'm going to come off of something that you just said there, Phil, about local democracy. And this question is posed to Bill. So, you know, looking at the history of conservative governments with conservation authorities, just to clarify, sounds like what you're saying is that Mike Harris downloaded responsibility for financing the conservation authorities down to local authorities, and now the Ford government is trying to eliminate local control. So it's being locally funded and not locally controlled. Is that a correct framing?
Yes, it is.
And the irony of that is the current government is using the funding argument as a rationale for getting rid of conservation authorities.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting to know. I learned from somebody in the chat that Councillor Gibson, I guess, made a comment when the motion to oppose Schedule 6, I guess, came up at council. He said that he was speaking in favor of the schedule, saying that it would correct an imbalance between local democracy and appointed representatives. So I'm wondering if either of you have any comment on maybe where that rationale is coming from.
Mike,
go ahead first.
Go ahead, Phil. Well, I don't want to speak for the councillor in any way. I can say that there is a provision in the bill that says that the municipal representatives on conservation authorities have to be elected municipal councillors, whereas prior to this, councils could appoint citizens to be on the boards. And in many cases, it may, especially in the case of Toronto, for example, where they've cut council size to the fact now that a city councillor in Toronto essentially represents the equivalent of a riding with no staff. And so oftentimes they don't have time to be on the conservation authority. So oftentimes they'll appoint citizen experts, like, a hydrologist or somebody who brings expertise to the planning process. And so I think that's what he's referring to.
I think you're right, Mike, and I have some real concerns about that. It is not inappropriate for a council to delegate authority to a citizen expert, and I think that that actually Dan was fumbling all over himself to support public policy on this one. Truthfully, as long as we have in a city the size of Guelph a part-time council, I think it is both disrespectful and irresponsible to put that kind of authority on a councillor. That's a big authority, and you know, God bless Bob Bell and Rodrigo Galler for doing it. But the truth is, they have other responsibilities as well, and consequently, their energies are spread fairly thinly. I would much rather have Bill Mungall on there, or someone like Bill or Hugh Whiteley, who has some expertise and authority, or Dustin Brown, who knows engineering and hydrology. You don't want me. My background is not that. My background is more related to ethics and, you know, conflict theory, although I guess this is a conflict.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that one? Seeing none, so I will move on to a question from Sheila O'Reilly, which was, where do insurance companies stand in regard to this bill? Because they could be facing huge payouts for flooded basements. Are they hoping to rely on the act of God excuse to not cover, or are they also in opposition to these changes?
Yeah, Sheila, that's a great question, and I'll just let you know what I tried really hard to get the Insurance Bureau of Canada to speak out on this. And I think if we'd had more time, you know, I worked really hard to get the Ontario Federation of Agriculture to speak out against it. I was working with hunters and anglers. I was trying to think of organizations that the government would actually listen to. And we were working on insurers. And the only thing I can say is out of those discussions, I am working with some of the insurers around having them speak out a bit more on the climate crisis and risk associated with flooding, but we ran out of time as it related to Schedule 6.
I used to attend meetings that were sponsored by the Insurance Bureau of Canada. It was a committee called Catastrophic Loss Reduction, and they would often have expert panels and seminars in there. I can tell you that, and this goes back 10 years now, there was a great deal of concern about the mounting insurance costs that were largely a result of people finishing their basements more than they used to, but also a lack of updated engineering standards with respect to severe rainfall events that have become more severe and more frequent. And the insurance companies are very concerned about this because in just recent years, they have taken on a new line of insurance, which is protection from overland flooding, i.e. not the water that comes up out of your floor drain in the basement, but rather the water that comes through your basement window. They call that overland flooding. And that's a grave concern of the insurance company, because since they mounted the program, they've had to increase the premiums almost threefold. And even locally, the cooperators has spoken out on this issue. I think going back 2 or 3 years ago, the chair of cooperators actually made some major public statements about the concern that the industry had about the increase in rainfall events. So I'm sure that behind the scenes, even though Mike couldn't get them to speak out publicly, and I think that was a very smart move on Mike's part to try and get them to do so, I think they're very concerned. I'd be surprised that they'd not be concerned about the recent actions of the government in taking away, in effect, the bottom line authority of the conservation authorities to administer floodplain development.
Great, thank you, Bill. There's a quick question in the chat here, and it's addressed at Mike, and it's, what was the one-day insurance cost of the major flooding in Toronto a few years ago? Remember that off the top of your head?
I do, yeah, $84 million in 3 hours. pretty extensive. And I'm trying to go through the chat. OFA did come out opposed to Schedule 6. I'm going to be very clear. So I did work with OFA on that. So if I misled anybody on that, they opposed Schedule 6.
Okay. Another number I can throw out that's quite compelling too is that in August of 2010, there was a major flood in Hamilton, which has combined sewers. It's one of 16 municipalities in Ontario that have combined sewers where sanitary and storm mix together and can bubble up through your floor drain. So you're having to put up with other people's sewage in your basement. There was 8,200 homes had basement flooding at that time, and the province turned down the city of Hamilton for any disaster relief related to that incident, and have done so likewise in some other municipalities, such as Burlington. I think in the very next year had severe flooding as well. They similarly were turned down for disaster relief.
Okay, good to know. Just the queue right now, I'm going to ask a question quickly about the Greenbelt and wetlands and developments that are being planned under MZOs already. And then we're going to go to Nancy with a question. And then I heard that John Staggles had a hand up as well. So just so everybody knows, that's the order right now. So Mike or Bill or anybody else who kind of knows what's going on here, you know, we've seen reported in the news there are some development projects. I think it's I don't even want to say what it is because I don't remember what it is exactly, but something's being planned to be put on top of a wetland under an MZO, and people are pointing to connections between this bill and that going on, and also bringing up concerns about the green belt. And I know the premier is adamant, as he always has been, except behind closed doors, that there's going to be no development happening on the Greenbelt. So I'm wondering if either of you can comment on any of that. And Phil, I saw your finger up there too. So
what I heard, and Mike, you can confirm this, was that the plan for another ring highway around Toronto is significant with regards to impeding the Greenbelt. Mike, I think you probably have more detail on that than I do. So go ahead.
Yeah, so that you're referring to the GTA West Highway, which I've been ringing the alarm bells and opposing. So it will go through the Greenbelt in Vaughan region, and it will also pave over about 2,000 acres of prime farmland in the Peel Plain, which is outside of the Greenbelt, but still significantly important agricultural land. And it will cross 53 waterways, which raises some significant concerns as well, all to save commuters an estimated 30 seconds in their commute time at a cost of over $6 billion. So, you know, hopefully you'll join me. And there's a number of mayors, in particular, Rick Bonetta and Halton Hills, have been very vocal in opposing it. And then the development I think you're referring to is the one I brought up in my presentations, the Duffins Creek MZO, that has significant local opposition, including from First Nations, and the mayor of Ajax have been the two most vocal opponents, as well as the Toronto Region Conservation Authority has been very opposed to it. And it is that opposition that I think prompted the last second amendments to the bill that requires a conservation authority to issue a development permit for an MZO. And so I don't think we should give up our opposition to paving over the last provincially significant wetland along Lake Ontario and the GTA, because it's critical, and it'll be for a casino and a warehouse. So there are many other places you can build casino and warehouses in the area that doesn't pave over. And I would argue, do we need another warehouse? Because you can probably guess what company it's for. Even though I publicly shouldn't talk about that. And do we really need another casino? But anyway.
Yeah, good points. Bill, did you have anything to add there?
Not directly on the Greenbelt, but indirectly, yes. I think with the wider spread application in practice of MZOs, is going to soon butt into another local greenbelt issue that's also administered by policy from the Ministry of Municipal Affairs, and that's in the form of the official plan designations for natural heritage areas, which are designated in Guelph's official plan under OPA 48 and in official plans as they're updated in all other municipalities in Ontario. And there's a conflict between issuing MZOs in designated natural heritage areas, and if the MZOs are being issued by the Minister of Municipal Affairs, he's also the same minister who's administering these official plan policies that require that each municipality have natural heritage designations in official plans, which are largely science-based. That minister is going to embarrass himself repeatedly if he continues to issue a lot of MZOs in natural heritage areas. And what I see is that the work that was done on the Conservation Authority's review bill through the omnibus bill, watch out, because that could be the thin edge of the wedge, and the next driving of the wedge will be dismantling of natural heritage designations in official plans and reverting to something else. I am quite concerned about that those will also be subject to MZOs and a policy change to relax those requirements in land use planning and official plans throughout the municipal realm in Ontario. They're in effect our local green belts, even though they're not called that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. I'll turn things over to Nancy now. So Nancy, you have questions or comments? I'm sure we're all interested to hear what you think of this whole shindig too. So I'll leave it to you.
Yeah. Wow, thank you. I'm a political scientist by education, so I'm like pretty hyped up right now. So thank you. I haven't engaged in that work for a few years now. So thank you. I learned so much about what is going on. And what I wanted to know is that for several years, I've been asking anytime I get an opportunity to consult or advise with conservation authorities, I always ask them, first of all, I have to teach them some things in history and about Indigenous rights and things like that. And I always ask them, you know, like, how come, you know, the consultation and consent, let me say meaningful consultation and consent and maybe even co-planning around water and land, you know, is sort of, it's not in very good way. I don't think it's taken very seriously. And I wonder if any conservation authorities have, or even politicians or city developed around meaningful consultation and consent, because this is another issue. I apologize, but it's another issue. It's another layer that's coming up. If any of you have heard about like land back initiatives, you know, I think there's one out in Guelph for Waterloo. And then of course we have Caledonia going on over here. And those things are starting to pop up. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and disconnect between the role that I heard, I think maybe Mike mentioned that they were working with some First Nations. And I'm not sure there's a clear understanding around, you know, that you're actually working with a colonial structure that today is called Chief and Council. And, you know, on the ground, we're saying that their jurisdiction is only the boundaries of the reservation. And, you know, we also have those people like myself, you know, that, you know, I heard mention about those people who are delegated authority as a citizen expert. I guess that would be the best way to translate it for you, is that the you know, or in our world, we call it grassroots or inherent right holders, the ones who are operating outside of sort of this colonial structure, in that at New Credit, and this is not a negative thing to say about our First Nation or whatever they're calling us these days, is that we actually strategize around what are the limits of consultation with chiefs and councils versus the limits of consulting with on the grassroots. And that's not unheard of. It's a strategy, it's a decolonizing like strategy. And so I wonder, you know, how much outreach have conservation authorities or the leadership who are dealing with these things, what kind of outreach, you know, in terms of building a relationship and maybe listening to, or, you know, my dream is that conservation authorities, because our interests are so similar, is that I'm not sure they're considering how Indigenous rights can actually support these initiatives. And because that's sort of the final frontier, is those inherent Indigenous rights, you know, and those treaties, which people really don't understand the laws outlined in there. And then we really don't understand what is the role of the matriarchs, the grandmothers, in the work that's happening in our territories. And we don't have, you know, kudos to Guelph, because actually Guelph City Council has reached out and we've started a relationship in very early stages, of course, but it's some kind of, you know, hope for this awareness and education, where we can get to a point where we can actually take some action. And I wondered if there was any initiatives or even protocols around, you know, how do you engage First Nations? And I think this is a really good time to be examining that, because I know our First Nation, our First Nation is actually right now, we're in the midst of, I think it's 5 or 6 water claims. And so this is where we can either start butting heads or do the same old, same old, or we can sit down and say, how can we do this differently? And how can we look at those water claims and use that to our advantage to protect what's important, which is the water and land, like for our grandchildren. So, but we need to do that on a sort of a multi-pronged way, in that you have chief and council, and then you have your on the ground water activists or land activists, like people like myself, to help advise and navigate our world and learn from your world. And so I think there's a big, I don't know what to call it, unawareness or maybe an ill education around jurisdictions. And I think that there's a, you know, I want to put a call out to conservation authorities and leadership, regardless of the level, local or provincial. I want to put a call out to say that we need to start talking, we need to start building a relationship, and we need to start strategizing around these things together. And it's real easy, like in the Canadian politics, to try to project that same type of system onto Anishinaabe and Anaknanokewan, or the way we do things. And so I'm not sure that was really a question, but yeah, I guess it was a question in what is happening, what's going on with First Nations and outreach.
Yeah, I'll try. Thanks, Nancy. So, you know what, I'm going to take everything that you've just brought up and take it to the head of Conservation Ontario, who I've built a pretty good relationship with. And so I don't want to speak on their behalf, but I can tell you one thing that I would love to work with you on. And it was a challenge that I encountered in drafting amendments that would require First Nations consent for water bottling permits. And I was working with some Indigenous legal experts. And one of the challenges I ran up against was So is it the band council that grants consent? Because you could argue the band council is a colonial structure. Is it hereditary chiefs who grant consent? And then when I was working with the drafters at Queen's Park, they were like, we don't even know how to draft this in the legislation for you. And so I can't tell you the struggle I was going through, even just figuring out how to draft it into legislation to propose the amendment. And then we finally landed on something. And then, of course, the government voted it down anyway. But I think those are really, like, very important issues that I think legislators need to struggle with, legislative bodies need to struggle with. And I'm very keen on continuing to work on those kinds of conversations and relationships, because I would love to be at a point where we could, you know, be able to have a clear legal understanding of how we actually implement it, consent. And it's a big challenge right now, I can tell you from my own experience.
Just want to make sure we get a chance to hear from Bill, and we've also got the question from John Stagel's upcoming, and we are over time. So I just want to make sure we keep moving things along. So Bill.
I'll pass.
Okay. Nancy, any closing thoughts on that?
I would love to help. It's actually, there's no way I could do it in 2 or 3 minutes here. It's so complex, but I could definitely help you there.
Very good. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, that's all we've got time for today. Thanks to all who participated. And to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Ault, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gevert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many special supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions, or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. If you'd like to support the work that we do on this program, please visit patreon.com and look for Breezy Bullhorn. Thanks for supporting and for listening.